I'm very grateful for this opportunity to be with all of you this evening. And I sincerely thank you for taking your very precious time to be with us. The subject I was asked to speak was Vedic solutions to climate change. Recently, well, it was actually a couple years ago, I was in Udupi, a very spiritually holy place in South India. The place I was staying was on a dirt road, which was quite away from the city or the town. And every day I would look outside my window and see a little puppy dog. There were two little puppy dogs. And the mother was always trying to protect them. Because I had heard from people in the house I was staying that two of her other puppies were run over by cars and killed right in front of her eyes. And these were her two surviving children. So you can imagine how fearful, how attached, and how protective she was after seeing two of her own children killed by cars. Now, one of these little puppy dogs, very small, just like a little ball of fur, was so energetic. He was just running and jumping and leaping. And one day, he decided he wanted to dig a hole that he could lay in. So he was working for hours and hours every day, just digging on the side of the road, digging, digging. And the mother would come up and lick him and smell him and feed him. And he was just... very attentive, intense, determined. About 3-4 days he was digging until the hole was about a foot deep. And when he finally got that hole really nice, he went inside, curled up, and went to sleep. And I walked by and I saw, and it was like he was in heaven. It was his own custom-made, personally tailored bed. One day it was about 7 o'clock in the morning. I was walking, chanting God's names, japa, along railroad tracks. And I was coming back. And I turned onto this road, and there was a car. The car was going down the road, but somebody parked a motorbike right in the middle of the road. So the car turned off the road, you know, just went to the side, and I saw the front tire sink, and I heard... And then the back tire, I saw it sink, and there was only silence. It was the dog. Suddenly I heard the most piteous, heart-cracking howl of his mother. I won't try to imitate that howl. it was the howl of a totally distressed, broken heart. And I saw her running and running and running. And she came to that hole, and I ran to the hole. And the little puppy, blood was streaming out of its nostrils and out of its mouth. And it was in so much pain, its little legs were flapping uncontrollably. And the mother was looking at it, looking at him. And I sat right next to him, and the mother understood that dogs are people too, what to speak of cows. She understood that I cared. So I sat right in front of that little dog and loudly chanted the holy names, because he was going to die. And she stepped back and just watched as I was chanting. And the paws were flapping, flapping. Then they both went up and slowly came down, and he was dead. And as soon as he stopped breathing, and it was very, very pronounced, that moment, I heard the mother. It was the most eerie, heartbreaking sound you can imagine. He just went, and I looked over, and tears were streaming from both sides of her eyes, down her fur. And I stepped aside, and she ran over, and she was licking the dead body of her little child, licking and licking and licking frantically, as if she was trying to lick life back into him. But he was gone. And for the next several hours, she just kept licking the little body of her child. And then his little brother came, and he just sat on the side of the hole watching his mother licking, and he started crying and going, That night, this happened in the morning, that night, all night long, I came out to look out the window, and I saw the mother. She would walk a few steps and come back and lick her little baby. She would walk 20 steps and come back. She would walk 30 steps and come back. Finally, I asked a neighbor, because, you know, it wasn't my property. I couldn't do anything. I said, could you bury this little puppy, because the mother is not going to get over this until it's out of sight. So the neighbor did that. But then I saw the mother and her baby for the next 2-3 days was just going and crying over that hole and smelling the hole. And people say that that animals are not people. As Gauranga Prabhu explained, I did take care of cows for about 8 years. And many times I would assist in the giving birth of a calf. And when that calf would die, how the mother would cry, how the mother would weep. And when the calf was alive, how she licked it and cared for it and gave it milk. These animals may not have the intellectual, philosophical capacity we have, but their will to live and their concern for each other, their feelings, are very similar. A human mother wouldn't suffer too much more than that dog mother. at seeing the loss of her baby. One of the basic foundational principles of Vedic culture is the respect of life. Paradukaduki, that another person's suffering should be our suffering. Another person's happiness should be our happiness. Vidyavanaya sampani brahmani gavihastini suni chaiva swabhake cha pandita samadarshana. What does it mean to be learned according to Bhagavad Gita? Actually being learned from a Vedic perspective means that you see everyone with equal vision. Whether one be a Brahmin or whether one be working in the fields. Whether one be an elephant, a cow, or a dog. One sees the soul, the Atma, a part of God, wherever there is life. It shouldn't be that we're only compassionate toward those that are relevant to me. In the West, a person's dog is really a part of the family. People will walk behind their dog with special plastic gloves. And when the dog responds to nature's call, which is what they like to do, and they just do it in your front yard, you can call the police and have that person fined unless he personally picks up that warm and the smushy in the winter smoking excrement. And he has to pick it up with that hand and a special bag he puts it in. And he's carrying, in one hand, he's carrying a bag with the dog's excrement. And in the other hand, he has his glove. He takes it off and puts it in the bag. And then, you know, the dog, the nature of dogs, they like to do things in installments. I have observed like this. So they're very meticulous, very possessive. If you kick their dog, they'll be outraged. But then they go home and eat cows and lambs and chickens and don't think twice about it. They feel as much as their dog. They care for their children as much as that dog does. But because it's not relevant to me, it doesn't matter if it suffers. Compassion comes to higher level, to the level it's more and more inclusive of other living beings. Compassion only for those people that are very directly involved with my life because of my attachment for them. It's compassion, but it's a type of selfish compassion. To the degree our compassion is selfless, it's not about me, it's about that person. That's real compassion. The greatest need in the world today. Now back to that little puppy. His story is very much the story of humanity. He worked so hard with such determination and attention to dig a hole that he could enjoy. But the very hole became the cause of his suffering and death. You have heard this saying, to dig your own grave. Well, on that particular day, that saying, it echoed within my mind as a brutal reality. Yes, we work very hard. But human intelligence is to look into the future and understand deeper and higher principles than just the temporary accomplishments we make and the pleasures that we derive from them. That's intelligence. Mary Shelley wrote a novel called Frankenstein. Have you all heard of that? Frankenstein is a monster. But that's not really the purpose. Dr. Frankenstein, he had very noble and good ideals. He wanted to create an ideal human being that could live extraordinarily long and could help the world. But the problem, he was meddling with the laws of nature. Although his intents may have been good to help, because he wasn't really seeing the whole picture of how the world works. He wasn't really seeing the way God works. In his attempt to make something for the benefit of man, he created a monster that terrorized him and all the people in the area. He dug his own grave. From the Vedic perspective, this is very much what's happening to the world today. Our sciences, our technologies, our industries, even if there's good motivations, unless we understand the laws of nature, the laws of God, and take responsibility for what we're doing, we can create monsters that become totally out of our control. You just saw some nice videos with statistics of what's going on. I was given pages and pages and pages of statistics about what's happening to the water on the global level. What's happening to the earth on the global level? What's happening to the forests? What's happening to the rivers and the air? And the rise in cancer and the rise in heart disease and the rise in depression and stress and mental illness. And they're all interrelated. And what to do with all the global warming and all the toxic waste? Practically 80% of the rivers of India are so toxically polluted, the Yamuna and the Ganges, hundreds of times beyond what's safe for a human being to even touch. And that's not being caused by the monkeys or the deers or the cows. Not even the snakes. It's caused by us, the humans, who are supposed to be so intelligent. Yes, we make progress. We make facilities to enjoy. But at what cost? And where is it going? Even the biggest brains in the world, geologists and scientists who are actually concerned, it's just so out of control. Don't know what to do. Now, from the Vedic perspective, because today's topic is Vedic solutions to climate change. According to many scientists and geologists, because of all the toxic waste and all of the pollution and all of the greenhouse effect and gases and synthetic chemicals in the ozone and everywhere else, because the earth is so polluted, and because of, from a spiritual perspective, according the karma is so polluted worldwide, there's going to be reactions. Now, the Vedic solution always goes to the essential cause. And what is the essential cause of all, of everything? It is consciousness. If we deal properly with consciousness, then we can substantially, realistically deal with the problems of this world. Otherwise, we're just doing patchwork. There's an infection and we just put some salve and a band-aid on it. And another perfection is salve and a band-aid. But if you have disease in the blood, you have to cure the blood. The underlying cause of all the pollution in the world is polluted consciousness. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells, I lost it. Bhumira pondalo vayu kama no buddhir eja evacha ahankara iti ame bina prakritirashtata. Krishna is explaining from the perspective of the divine that there are eight material elements: earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, and intelligence, and the ego. But beyond this, there is a superior energy, the jiva, the source of consciousness, which is actually the very foundational sustaining force of creation. Consciousness is the sustaining force of creation. The reason for the ecological pollution is very simple: the pollution of consciousness. Because our minds are highly polluted with toxic greed. What is the nature of greed? It can never be satisfied. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, Prahlad Maharaj explains that if you're hungry, you eat some food, you're satisfied. If you're thirsty, you drink some liquid and you're satisfied. If you're angry, you let it out, or someone chastises you and you get the reaction to it, and basically your anger is subdued. But Prahlad says, but greed, even if you conquer, control, and become the proprietor of everything within the entire universe, your greed will never be satisfied. It's insatiable. It burns like fire. The more fuel you put in it, the hotter and higher it burns. The Vedic solution is to learn how to be content and satisfied with simple things. Due to ignorance, avidya, we're trying to find happiness in things, in stuff. But the soul is part of God. Mamaivam so jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana. The soul, the heart, needs love. It's the only thing that can satisfy us, is to love and be loved. Even on a very worldly sense, if you have everything else, but you don't have someone to love, and you're not loved by people, there can be no real satisfaction. Because things cannot touch the heart. Sensual pleasures, mental pleasures do not touch the heart, and satisfaction is not a thing of the mind, it's not a thing of the flesh, it's a thing of the heart. Our nature is to love God. And in loving God, we see every living being as part of God. We naturally love every living being. That brings contentment. Relationships bring satisfaction. But unfortunately, we become so obsessed with trying to find that satisfaction by accumulation and experiential interactions with things that we don't have healthy, satisfying relationships. We don't take responsibility for our relationships because they're not very important. We're preoccupied. Yes, and in the so-called developed countries, materially, we find massive divorce rates, massive mental depression. Why? They have things, but responsibilities, family values, relationships are compromised. And therefore their hearts are empty. Their bank accounts may be overflowing, but their hearts are empty. Their prestige and their fame may be skyrocketing. But without meaningful, deep, loving relationships, there's nothing there inside the heart. And there, to fill that emptiness, we become greedy. We become lusty. And when it's not fulfilled, we become angry. And if we get what we want, we become arrogant. And if we don't get what we want, we become envious and depressed. These are all just symptoms of a very sick, empty state of consciousness. And yet in today's world, the people who are the sickest, who are the most macho into stepping on people's heads to get ahead, they're considered great heroes. But the Vedic solution is something very different. To find substantial satisfaction within. And that is called, by our Gurudev Prabhupada's terminology, simple living and high thinking. We don't need unnecessary necessities. Whether you're living in a beautiful palace, or whether you're living in a straw hut, or whether you're living in a cave, if you're satisfied within, you'll be happy. But if you're not satisfied within, you're really going to be bored in that cave. You're going to really be depressed about the straw hut. And as far as the palace, you're going to be in complete anxiety about everybody else who wants the palace and all the things that are going wrong in your palace and all the problems with the mortgage for the palace. And everything going on inside. There can be no satisfaction. When little Vamanadeva approached Bali Maharaj, he was a penniless little Brahmin dwarf, and he asked Bali, "Give me 3 steps of land." And Bali said, "Do you know who I am?" Actually, I'm putting the words in his... He didn't say exactly like that. He was speaking in Sanskrit. I'm putting it in common English language. He says, I'm the king. Why 3 steps of land? I'll give you houses. I'll give you property. I'll give you a planet. I'll give you everything you want. I have it. And essentially, Vamanadeva said, "What do you have?" Said, "I have nothing, but because I have peace of mind, I'm happy. You have everything, but because you have peace of mind, you're miserable." And Bali Maharaj couldn't argue with that one. If you're not happy within yourself, you cannot be happy no matter what you get, no matter what you achieve. And if you're happy within yourself, you're happy no matter what you get or what you achieve. If you can't be satisfied with a little, you cannot be satisfied with a lot. That is an eternal principle. So Bhagavad Gita is not teaching poverty. But at the same time, it is teaching poverty. Poverty in a different way. We see Mahabharata, Srimad Bhagavat, so many scriptures. Many of the great saints we read about are kings and queens. They have royal wealth. But they're self-realized. They're perfect yogis. Because they don't consider their wealth to be their own. They consider everything to be the property of God. And they care for it and utilize it, not only for their own well-being, but for their families and for the world's well-being. They're not greedy. They're generous. They're kind. They're compassionate. So we find kings and we find sadhus who just sleep on the banks of rivers. They both have the same wealth within. Queen Kunti prays that one can feelingly chant God's name and access his mercy when akinchana gocharam. When one understands, nothing is mine. Everything belongs to God. Bhoktaram jagatapasam sarvaloka maheshwaram suhradam sarvabhutanam yatvamam shantimrichchati. Krishna says in Gita, if you want to be peaceful, it's very simple. The peace formula of the fifth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Just to accept that God, Krishna, is the proprietor of everything, is the controller of everything, and everything is ultimately for his satisfaction. Whether we're a king, whether we're an industrialist, or a doctor, or a teacher, or an author, or a student, or a housewife, or a farmer, or a sadhu. If you understand this principle, you could be peaceful in every single situation that comes upon you. But if you don't understand this principle, and you want to be the proprietor, you want to be the controller, and you want to be the enjoyer, it's not possible to be peaceful. Not for any duration, because it's an unnatural situation. It's not real. It's illusion. If you take a fish out of the sea and throw him in the sand, that fish, you can give him the most beautiful female fish to flap on the sand right next to each other, and they'll be flapping into each other. You could give that fish the best possible food, his favorite food, whatever it may be. You can give that fish a diamond necklace from one of the best stores just down the street in Mumbai. In fact, there's a place that sells Mercedes-Benz. You can give him a Mercedes. Or what is that food they sell at Chopati Beach? Bell. You can give him... You could run across the sand and get him a whole plate of bell puris. And he'll eat the bell puris and... He's thinking, now I'm so happy. But he's not happy. It's not real happiness. Until he goes back into the sea, which is his nature. So unless our consciousness returns to its original nature, we're not satisfied. And the farther humanity goes away from the very essence of who they are, who we are, the more we become entangled and we use this magnificent, incredible, creative brain that God has given humans to realize the highest essence and to create a civilization in harmony with that essence, we start creating things even in the name of good, sometime in the name of bad. We've created some really good bombs. Yes? Atomic bombs, hydrogen bombs, nuclear bombs. And they just keep getting better and better. And there are so many bombs in this world today, in so many countries. If America alone were to just release all their nuclear bombs, what to speak of Russia and China and Pakistan. and India. Everybody started releasing their bombs. Mumbai would go back to being Bombay. Wouldn't matter who, which political party is ruling. So, you know, the human intellect that takes to make those things, it's unbelievable. From the Vedic perspective, yoga means union. Yoga means harmony. The harmony between humans, between other species of life, between nature, and between God. That is yoga. Asanas, pranayama, yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, dharana, dhyana, samadhi, all of these different stages of yoga, they are all ultimately meant to bring our consciousness in harmony with nature, with other living beings, and with God. The earth is declared in the scriptures to be one of our seven mothers. Because like our mother, when we're infants in the womb, and when we just come out of the womb, we are totally dependent on our mother. Her compassion, her kindness, is our survival. Yes? The embryo in the womb, if the mother wants to kill it, what is the embryo can't fight back. Totally dependent on the mercy of the mother. And when it comes out, totally dependent again. Well, that's the way everyone is toward Mother Earth. She's supplying the water. She's supplying the fruits and the vegetables and the food grains. She's providing the air that we breathe. And that the earth is an expansion of the feminine potency of God. Krishna tells in Gita, Aham Bija Pratapita, that he's the seed-giving father of all living beings. But who's the mother? He's also the mother. Or she's also the mother. And very much through Mother Earth. Our bodies are made of the elements of the earth, are they not? Earth, water, fire, air, ether. The water comes from the earth, the ether comes from the earth, the fire, the earth. Our bodies are made out of Mother Earth. Just like our bodies are made from our mother, biologically. And according to the Vedic principles, there is a deity, there is a presiding personality in the earth. In fact, she is the consort, the eternal consort of Varahadev, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Just as Varaha is an expansion of Krishna, Bhumi is an expansion of Radha, an expansion of Lakshmi, an expansion of Sita. Sita is Ram's consort. Now, Hanuman, he was intelligent. He understood that everyone's welfare, including his own, and is force Sita and Ram to be united. But Ravana, his mentality, he was greedy. He was lustful. He was selfish and arrogant. In his conception, I want to enjoy Sita for myself. And he was thinking he would be happy by doing it. Even though so many people warned him against it. His own wife, Mandodari, send Sita back. I'll do everything and anything you want. Just, I'm your wife, what's wrong with me? Send Sita back. Vibhishan, you will be destroyed. She is Ram's consort. You cannot take what belongs to Ram. Even Kumbhakarna warned his brother, I'll fight for you, but you're... But if you want my advice, you better give Sita back to Ram. And Hanuman came and said, if you want a taste of what Ram is going to do, I'm just his menial, humble, insignificant servant, and watch what I do. And he burned the whole city. So what was Ravana's illusion? He wanted to exploit God's consort for himself. And Hanuman wanted to serve God's consort in harmony with the will of Ram. Now in Ramayana, you know, Sita came out of the earth. And at the end of her Leela, she went into the earth. That's not an accident. Because she's none different than Mother Earth. The earth is Sita. It's Bhumi. An expansion. The Vedic solution is we understand the reality as it is. The natural resources are sacred. They are God's energy. And how we respect and utilize them is what's going to determine the fate of the world. There was an Indian chief, and not East Indian, but American Indian. His name was Chief Seattle. Seattle, Washington was named after him, actually. Seattle. And there's a famous statement. Some say he said it, some said other people said it, but whoever said it, it was a good thing to say. Essentially, he saw when the Europeans came to the West, America, the Indians, American Indians, they were much more Vedic in the sense that they really honored Mother Earth. They considered the earth and all the gifts of the earth to be sacred. And if you take something, you have to take it carefully with respect and honor, and you have to replenish it. You can't just take without replenishing with something in a very good way. If you cut a tree, you have to plant another tree. If you grow a crop, you have to do it in such a way that you're not plundering the earth, but you're nourishing and restoring the earth. It's a natural science. And when the American Indians saw the Europeans coming, they were just cutting and leaving things in waste, planting and ripping. Well, to speak of stealing all the land from them themselves and putting them in prison camps, reservations. And he wrote something. He said, Mother Earth, it's like your bed. If you contaminate your bed, you're going to have to sleep in it. It's reality. all the gifts that God has given us are sacred. Every breath is a gift of Mother Earth. Without it, we all die. Every drop of water, every pinch of soil. And what a miraculous mother, the earth. You go to the Himalayas and you see some yogi produce some ashes and you think, oh, how wonderful. But every day, Mother Earth, some little seed, a tree grows, and hundreds of fruits and flowers. You can't even eat ashes. We see fruit trees. We see flower trees. Every time we eat, just from a seed in the ground, just mix water, mix a seed, mix earth, and rice, chapati flour. With a little, mixing a little together, gulab jamuns, halava. So many natural gifts. It's a miracle everywhere. Vegetables, fruits, and each one is so different and so amazing. There's grapes and there's mangoes and there's papayas and there's chikus. There's cashews. Can't we recognize the sanctity of Earth as our mother? So environmentalism, from the Vedic perspective, is a divine service to God. It goes way beyond just building a better future for humanity. It's an inseparable part of Dharma. Is to love, honor, and respect our mother. And from that perspective, everyone's mother. And this mother, if you're married, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, your great-great-grandchildren, your great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren, the same mother is going to be required to provide for them. It's very personal, and it's our dharmic responsibility. If we just have that type of consciousness, we could be happy with the simple things that God provides if we just learn the art of using them in harmony with the will of God. Now, some people may think that this philosophy will make people very lazy and weak. Yes, unless you're like Ravana, unless you really are selfish, unless you're really egoistic, you're not really motivated to do things. That illusion is totally dispelled by Hanuman. Who is more dynamic? Who is more hard-working than Hanuman? He could lift mountains. He could build bridges of rocks across an ocean. He could jump across the ocean. He could burn cities. He can fight Rakshasas. Hanuman was not a lazy bhakta. He wasn't, you people, you follow bhakti, what are you going to do for the world? Lazy, you just sit in some ashram and chant. What are you doing? It's like our Param Guru Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. During World War II, there was an after. You know, he was, so many devotees were coming, and they were fighting a war against Maya out of compassion for all living beings. Lord Chaitanya taught a battle against Maya. It's totally nonviolent, but it's war against ignorance, illusion, and suffering through enlightenment, knowledge, and grace. But one of the big, big Indian generals came to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. And he's saying, you're recruiting all these good men that we could use in the army to fight against the British, and you're making them sadhus. We need them. They're just lazy here in the ashram. We need them to fight for freedom. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said, they are very skinny and weak. They can't help your army very much. Let them just eat some prasad and do something good for But actually they were doing so good. You know, Mahatma Gandhi was not physically a powerful soldier, but he did more than all the other soldiers, because he had character and integrity. So Hanuman taught us how to live in harmony with the will of Sita. Hanuman taught us how to dedicate our lives to honoring, respecting, and protecting Sita. We have Sita sitting right there, actually. Sita Devi Dasi. In harmony with the will of Ram. This is the Vedic solution to climate change. To change our consciousness. To change it from little Ravanas to little Hanumans. From protecting the earth, from exploiting the earth for our own purposes, to protecting and honoring the earth for God's purposes. And actually, there is no other permanent solution. All other solutions, whether they come out of the United Nations or any other environmentalist organization, they may be good. They may be necessary. They may be vital. And many of these organizations are, you know, we bow to them for their good efforts. But we must understand, unless there is a change in consciousness, it's not sustainable. Without a change of consciousness, even environmentalism is unsustainable sustainability. Does that make sense? I once met with, some years ago, the minister for the environment for India. We had a good discussion. And I was explaining to her. She challenged, what are you sadhus doing for the environment? The rivers are polluted, the land is polluted, the air is polluted. So much poison, so much toxic waste, so much dangers, ozone, greenhouse, all these things are happening, and you're just, you know, doing your mantras. So these mantras clean the heart. The reason for all this ecological pollution is because of pollution in the heart. And even if, by making laws and reforms and educating the public very nicely about the importance of cleaning up the environment. If you clean every river, every ocean, every bit of land, and clear the air and the sky, it's guaranteed. If we don't clean the pollution of toxic greed in people's hearts, they're going to pollute everything all over again, 100%. So we have to harmoniously work side by side. We have to do these things. But we also have to educate people how to find satisfaction and fulfillment in the simple divine gifts that God has given us. Lord Chaitanya, he wrote 8 verses, Shikshastakam. It begins, Chaito Darpana Marajanam Bhava Mahada Bhakti Nirvapanam. Chaito Darpana Marajanam means that the mind is like a mirror that is covered with dirt. To the degree the mind is covered with dirt, it's going to impel us to speak and to act in karmic ways that pour that dirt all over the world in so many ways. And factually, disasters are very much reactions of collective karma. If we keep, Mother Earth has a body, and it's very much like our body. Mother Earth, like our body, when there's some problem, she heals herself. Yes, you have a cut, it heals itself. A good doctor doesn't heal it for you. A good doctor depends on the body to heal itself. You could have certain types of surgeries where the doctors become, you know, they do a lot of manipulation of things. But if the body doesn't help and heal itself through that process, the person's going to die. Yes? So Mother Earth heals herself. But like our body, if the body is exploited, and filled with more and more and more toxins, it is never given the time to replenish itself, then it can't heal itself. It turns into serious diseases. And similarly, Mother Earth, same thing. But when she gets diseased, the reactions are severe. They could be tsunamis, they could be earthquakes. It is connected with karma. It is not just some ideological theory. It is the gravest necessity for humanity today and for all times to clean the ecology of our consciousness. And the simplest, most powerful cleansing agent to remove the pollution of our minds and our hearts and restore the love, the compassion, and the inner satisfaction that we're all longing for is the chanting of God's holy name. Chant sincerely, God appears before you. Is there any questions? Would you like to speak something first? Gauranga Prabhu?
Thank you, Maharaj, for that wonderful presentation.
Just keep pondering this mystery, and you will become perfect. Bhumi is an expansion of Sita. Harival.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Maharaj, just want to share one small incident. When we sit to have prasad at our house, my mother does a small thing. She offers whatever she has in her plate to Mother Earth. And I always used to ask, what are you doing? So my mother always used to say that I am just offering. Before I have the prasad, I offer it to Mother Earth. And I never used to understand the procedure, why she is doing. So today, through your lecture, I could understand that. Thank you very much, Maharaj.
Please request your mother to bless me. Motherly blessings are very powerful.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Hare Krishna Maharaj. Thank you very much for a wonderful discourse. Maharaj, I just wanted to ask that you mentioned that, you know, we should understand that everything is Krishna's property. So many times, you know, I fit it in my mobile as well. I keep reminder, and to certain people also, you know, I just keep that person is Krishna's devotee. But then, you know, at times it happens that, you know, we are not able to have that strong realization. So how should we go about it? That 24/7 we should remember that every single thing is actually Krishna's property.
How to remember that?
Yeah, how to have that strong realization.
Many ways. By associating with people who help you remember it. By doing things that help you remember it. By reading Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, that will help you remember it. By hearing classes. By associating with people who are trying to live by those principles. By our prayers, by our chanting, and by consciously trying to offer our work in the service of Krishna, of God. The whole path, process, and science of bhakti is to help us to be aware of that truth. As you said, 24/7. But because for so long we have chronically been habituated to forgetting that, it takes time to bring our consciousness back to its natural state of always remembering God with love. Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, thank you very much for the very wonderful perspective that you gave on this problem. Maharaj, as you said, that the ecology of our heart, that is polluted. So when we come to the process of Krishna consciousness, so we understand that this pollution is there within the heart, and we get the process of chanting the holy names, and we move ahead on the path of our life. And we have come from a background of this materialistic education, and then the options that we have is to enter to get a job which is in some multinational company, which is all about propagating all this pollution of the environment and of the consciousness. And we find that even if we want, we don't have options for us to work in a field by which we can also simultaneously, which is in alignment with this process of cleaning the consciousness. Or it's a passionate work that basically we are doing. So what we can do regarding that?
Well, personally, I became a Swami. I but I don't recommend that. What is important is we develop a foundation in our life of good character, spiritual values, and integrity. And once we have that foundation, then we should use our intelligence to do the very best we can according to our circumstance, to live in harmony with our own soul and with God and with nature. In Kali Yuga, especially, people are put in situations which are very contradictory to many spiritual ideals. In which case, if we are sincere, we try to make what Prabhupada said, the best use of a bad bargain. And that takes sincerity and intelligence. And even if we're in situations where externally we're implicated in a profession that may be harmful to the environment, if we sincerely work on purifying our own internal environment, and we also live by moral principles of integrity, then what happens is, because of that sincerity, Krishna empowers us with realizations, intelligence, and sometimes alternatives. What it really comes down to is, if we want to live with spiritual integrity, we have to stop blaming others. We have to be an example of what's right. It's a scapegoat which perpetually keeps things in a very sad condition. When we blame the government, when we blame the society, we blame so many things and so many people. We blame the country. But then we do the same things. We do the same things that we're blaming everybody else for. And we say, it's not my fault because everyone else does it. It's not my fault because the government can't stop it. You and me are 100% fully responsible for the care of the earth, whoever we are. Man or woman, old or young, IIT student or Swami. We're all responsible. The choices we make, how we respond to situations, the integrity in which we live our lives, that is our part of changing the world. Human life is quite unsubstantial and meaningless unless individual humans live by sacred ideals, no matter what else everyone else is doing, no matter how easy or hard it may be. And that's what changes things. If we look at history, the most major changes that affected nations, that affected the world, it started usually with just one or two people who had an ideal that seemed against all odds and impossible. Yes? Either for the good or for the bad. From the bad, Hitler, he had hatred, and on the base of that hatred, he wrote books about his ideals. And at the beginning, nobody listened to him. He started to preach them, and he got put in jail. Yes? But eventually, he just remained determined and fixed in those ideals. And certain social, environmental, political things changed, and all of a sudden, 2 people, 3 people, 4 people, 5 people, 5,000 people, 5 million people, 10 million people accepted. He started conquering nations, and he was trying to conquer the world. It was just one man with an idea. Later it became a few people, a few more people. And look what he did to the world, World War II, the massive death. And you have here in India, Gandhi, at August Krunti. He made his announcement with some of, it began with just him and a few people underground, hiding in some houses, just talking about how we should get rid of the British. It seemed absolutely impossible. But they talked about it. There were less people involved than are in this room. Yes? It was just a few people. Not long ago, I was at the Birla house, and there's the living room where he used to sit and meet. Gandhiji used to sit and meet with people. There was only about 10, 20 people he would meet with. It didn't go beyond them. An impossible thing. But because they lived by their ideal, he was also put in jail, as were most of his followers. But because they lived by their ideals, look at the change they created in the world. Not only in India, the civil rights movement in America, Martin Luther King, the blacks were slaves for over a century in America. Slaves bought and sold with no rights. They were owned by people. And there was a war to banish slavery, but it hardly changed the mentality. They were still treated that way, even though it was unofficial. They weren't bought and sold. They were just forced to live in a ghetto and die in a ghetto with no rights, hardly. Martin Luther King, he was inspired by Mahatma Gandhi. And he started the same little thing. Nonviolent demonstrations. He was put in jail. And the result? There's an African-American president of the United States. Just one generation after Martin Luther King, where a African-American person couldn't sit in the same bus or go to the same college in many states of America as a white man or woman. Little things become big. Thomas Edison, he had this idea, I'm going to create light. Yes? By just using God's energy. He had religious principles. God's energy is miraculous. Let me use God's energy in a certain way. Benjamin Franklin, he wanted to channel God's energy to create electricity. Nobody was thinking in those terms. But now, everywhere in the world, you see light bulbs. Yes? Everywhere in the world, you see electricity. Major change from lanterns, but it's just one or two people who just had an idea, and their idea changed the world because they live by it. They were willing to die for it. Our own Gurudev, Srila Prabhupada, 70-year-old man on the Jaladuta boat. He had 2 heart attacks on the boat. Came into New York, lived in the Bowery, a ghetto, had no money, had no contacts, had absolutely no support from anyone in India because they all thought it's impossible what you're doing. Even his own god brothers, even his well-wishers, they said it's impossible, just come back. He had no support anywhere. But he lived by his ideal. And that's why we're all here today. From that little ideal of a man with a little box of Indian printed books, which is all he had that, an umbrella, a little bag of cereal, and a change of clothes. That was it. But because he lived by his ideal, hundreds and millions of Vedic translations of Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Ishopanishad, Nectar of Devotion, the largest volume of Vedic literatures in the history of the world. Hundreds and millions have been published and distributed. And hundreds of temples and millions of devotees. And his mission is just getting started. Just one man, he just had an idea and lived by it. So let's stop blaming other people and using that as an excuse to just remain complacent. A fulfilling life is a life where we live by sacred ideals. And any one of us can make a major change in the world. And when we're collectively sharing those ideals, super extra potency of God comes into that collective unity and purity. This is the greatness of India. Is there such a deep, all-inclusive, profound, scientific understanding of God, of the soul, and our relationship with nature and each other beyond all distinctions? Does that answer your question?
What can we do individually and collectively to be internally and externally clean and safe, south Madhravat? And what can we do actually? A little brief insight and perspectives. What can we do actually to do that individually and collectively?
If we have a desire, then so many ideas will emerge. It's like our little temple here have a desire because we see that it's very important to create alternative examples for people to see. So recently we started a farm project in Wada. It's called Govardhan Farm. Yes. And some people may think we have 50 acres of land, we're growing rice and flowers and vegetables, and we have, what, about 650 fruit trees now. And we, instead of tractors, we use oxen, and we have nice, about 30, 40 cows and our own bulls. And we're showing protection of cows, compassionate protection of cows, because a cow is one of the mothers also. She gives milk. And the bull is like a father, because by tilling the fields, he's giving grains. And it's very sustainable. Not using unnecessary chemicals. It's very holistic, natural, replenishing. While we're taking from the earth, we're replenishing the earth. It's an exchange of love. And we're developing a retreat center. And we're trying to develop positive natural energy sources. And if we're content internally, this is opulence. It's beautiful. You know, a person who's content chanting God's names and serving others and living in a simple situation like that is probably going to be millions of times more internally happy and fulfilled than people who are going to high-tech discos in Mumbai. And the idea of this Govardhan Dham is to show people that it's a beautiful life. Now, we may think, what's a little 50-acre farm going to do to change the world? But we have to do our part. If we had the means to make a 1-million-acre farm, we would be happy to do that. But we have the means for this. And like we were explaining, all great changes throughout history that have taken place in the world, they always began very small with people who were committed to an ideal. So what comes out of it? That's in God's hands. But we're doing what we believe is right. And we're trying to be instruments of compassion and show alternatives to the world. Because there may be a time where the natural ways are the only ways left. The way we're accelerating and burning out the resources. Oil is limited. The world is very much based on an oil economy. It's reaching its peak. You're going to have to dig deeper and deeper and deeper to get it, and it's going to cost more and more and more money to get down there, and it's getting less and less and less. And we're creating a culture where we desperately need more and more and more and more and more. There's finite resources, and we have infinite demands. It's not going to work. It can't. It has no future. There has to be alternatives. Otherwise, there's going to be such a collapse, it's going to be drastic, unless there is alternatives. We could use things nicely, but we should actually be thinking in terms of the world and the future. There's shreyas and prayas. Prayas means we do what we need now without consideration of the future. Shreyas means our decisions now are holistic, thinking in terms of the future. A child likes to play. A parent says, go to school. The child says, no, I don't like school. I like to play. But the parent says, no, you have to discipline yourself and go to school. If The parent doesn't discipline the child. The child has no education and suffers the rest of his or her life. So we don't go to school because we like it today. We go to school because we're trying to pave, even if we hate it. In my case, I was like that. But we do it so we have a future. So as a society also, we have to think in those terms. As a society, we have to, it's not just about, you know, how to make profits and become rich and create facilities now through a very high level of consumerism. We're not for or against that. But what we're for is we have to look into how what we're doing now is affecting the future of humanity and the future of this world. And we have to start making adjustments so that we do have a good future. And every one of us is responsible, according to our means, to do that. So this farm is, we're hoping and praying that it could be a nice model to show people. It's not that we expect everyone to move to farm and take care of cows and plow with oxen, but if it can help people even in the city to understand the beauty of simplicity and to find pleasure and meaning in simple things, in our relationships and with God. I think I said this in another class, but not long ago I went to a very wealthy person's house in America. The mother works, the father works, and to keep the children busy, there's a basement with every possible thing to play with you can imagine. There is hundreds and hundreds of games and pinball machines and ping pong tables and billiard tables and all kinds of computer games and a little movie theater where the child could just, you know, press buttons and play any movie or cartoons or anything he wants. There were probably tens and thousands of dollars worth of toys, games, and entertainment system for two children. And to keep the children busy while the parents were working. And I'll tell you, those children didn't look happy at all. Do you know why they need tens and thousands of hundreds and hundreds of hundreds of these toys and games? Because the children aren't satisfied with any one of them. They play with one for a while, then they need a new one, and a new one, and a new one, and a new one, and a new one. And then I went to one little farm, not even a farm, it was a place in India, where one of my dear friends, I saw his daughter, was just sitting in some grass playing with a mango seed. You know, the parents ate the mango and gave the child the mango. I think actually the child ate the mango and then was playing with this mango seed and was completely happy. I can tell you 100% with certainty that this girl was happier with one mango seed than these other children with tens and thousands of dollars of every type of low-tech and high-tech entertainment games. And she was developing creativity, what she was doing with that mango seed. It was very artistic. She was developing her internal creative talents by just figuring out ways to play with that mango seed. Whereas these other games, you're just doing what they're telling you to do. simplicity. We don't need a lot of things. We could be content with small things. If we have that creative spirit and contentment within. I don't even remember who asked the question or what it was. But I did say what I wanted to say.
Thank you, Maharaj, for that brilliant answer. And as a first step to fulfilling Maharaj's desire, as he described about the Govardhan farm, just a couple of days back, there was a meeting in the Brahmacharya Ashram, and a group of young, enthusiastic, intelligent, hardworking Brahmachari trainee devotees, they have decided to move on to the Wada farm to help in its development. So we request all of them to stand up and take the blessings of all the assembled youth here. So they are all committed to try to develop this project and make it a success and make Maharaj's dream come true. Let us bless them by loudly chanting. Thank you all very much.
Next time you see them, they will have soil dirt on their dhotis.
We would like to welcome newcomers who have come for the first time. Please.
Mahaprasad.
Could you please stand up, those who have come for the first time, so that we can welcome all of you. Thank you for coming. There is a 6-session journey of self-discovery course being conducted between 14 to 19 March, if you are interested. The speaker would be His Grace Akinchan Krishna Prabhu. And also there is a 4-series lifestyle management seminar conducted every Sunday evening on stress management, time management, goal setting and harnessing mind power. So there is a registration counter for all of you below. And also a books and beads counter set up below. Let us welcome all of these new students by loudly chanting. Thank you very much. Kindly have your seat. We are very happy to announce that the next Prerna Festival will be on Saturday, April the 10th, and the speaker will be His Holiness Radhanath Swami Maharaj. So please do come in large numbers, and after that Maharaj will be out of India for a few months. So this will be the last Prerna Festival for a few months. So please do bring as many of your friends as possible, and the topic will be announced later. So April 10th, Saturday, next Prerna Festival. So now we request everyone to join for Kirtan. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.